to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We've got a great show for you today, but first, we're going to play some music from Valdi, and this is a song that's called A Good Song. So you be the judge. Is it a good song?
Not a free man, but neither am I chained. And I am not a wise man, but neither am I rearranged. I am not a new man, but neither am I old. I am not a rich man, but I cannot be sold. I am one, you are another. I have a family, you have a mother. A learned man, but neither am I a fool. I am not an ordinary man, but neither am I strange. I am not your man, but that can all be changed.
That was A Good Song, or so-called, by Valdi. You are listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Ryan Young. Welcome to the show. So today on the show, we have a special guest in the studio with us, and that's Michael Gemtrude, who is a architect and teaching here in the School of Architecture at McGill University. And he is the chair in Architecture, Energy, and Environment. And he is also a founding member of the DCARB, which otherwise is Decarbonizing Architecture and Building. It's a research group here at McGill University whose mission is to develop new concepts, methods, tools, and integrated solutions for the reduction of the global warming potential of the full building environments process. That's a mouthful. So Michael's also involved in a project that's going to be built out at McDonald campus, which is called BARN. And BARN stands for Building Architecture Research Node. It's essentially, I think, a green architecture research center. So that's another exciting project. He's got lots going on. So welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you, Ryan. Good to be here.
So I guess my first question is, well, what motivated you to become an architect?
That's a good question. Well, I originally started my career in philosophy, actually, but was when I was younger, I did a lot of construction, a lot of building. I grew up on a farm, and at one point I realized that there was actually a nice link between philosophy and architecture in terms of its social concerns, its political concerns, etc. So I transitioned into architecture at that point and finished my degree at Penn State University and also my philosophy degree there as well. And then did my graduate work at McGill, and I wouldn't have done any differently. It's a great education. It's not just about architecture. It's about society and about culture and a lot of other things. So it's always interesting, always important, I think today even more important considering the global climate crisis.
So you grew up in North Dakota?
North Dakota, yeah.
Nice. And then why did you choose to go to Penn State?
Actually, because they had a really good architecture program, but they had even a better philosophy program at the time. So between the dual degrees, it was just a good match. And I wanted to get to the East Coast, actually, out of the Midwest. Most of my friends went west. I went east, but that was the reason for going there. And I wouldn't have changed. I had so many great mentors there in both programs. I wouldn't have done it differently.
Nice. And I mean, and so how much in your current teaching does philosophy influence your teaching when it comes to architecture?
Quite a bit. You know, I just did a PhD defense with a young woman yesterday that did an amazing job with hers, and it was with her PhD, and it was heavily influenced within the phenomenological tradition and philosophy and things like that. So at McGill, and one of the reasons I'm here too, it's always had a long tradition of a very specific way of doing history, a theory of architecture, which is radically influenced by continental philosophy. So it's a good match too for my, it's why I'm here too. It's one of the reasons why I'm here, actually.
Wow. And you were the chair of the architecture department at one time. Your current projects really do focus on, I guess the right term would be ecological agriculture architecture, or would we say green architecture?
Yeah.
Low carbon.
Yeah. Yeah. The focus is really on trying to figure out how to decarbonize the industry, not just buildings, but the industry. So, and I have several really amazing colleagues that I'm working with now at McGill. So it's a very wide-reaching research and development program. It's very applied on some level. I do a lot of design build work. So we design and build projects, full-scale projects, not... And experiments, actually, because we have some colleagues that are doing some really interesting fundamental research in these areas that are relevant to architecture. Not just in architecture, too, by the way. It's working with people out at the Mac campus in agriculture and environmental sciences, with engineering, of course, with management, with geography, urban planning. So it takes a lot. It's a messy discipline in general, and it takes a lot of collaboration with a lot of different disciplines, and sort of built into our DNA as architects. So the idea of decarbonizing the whole industry is huge. I mean, I work really closely with Hydro-Québec, so of course operational energy of buildings is important, but I would say that our system boundary that we're looking at is really about the whole supply chain, all the way from how much energy did it take to grow a tree in the forest, and how can we synchronize our forestry practices more with our building practices. So it's a very wide-ranging research program, and luckily I have a lot of amazing colleagues to do this with. It keeps it fun.
And I guess Quebec could be an interesting place to be working on this because it has this massive energy company, which is Hydro-Québec, which for the most part is dealing in, some people would argue that not all hydro is green energy, but on the whole, clean energy.
Yeah, exactly. I think Hydro-Québec and my colleagues in their research wing there know very well that there's a lot of environmental impacts that just can't be externalized from any power company, and they're very aware of that, and they're doing their best to mitigate as much of that as possible. I believe that, and that's part of their interest in actually investing into developing a deep energy retrofit program for Quebec, which is one of the projects I'm working on. But we are, I think, blessed as Quebecers to have this infrastructure. It has a messy history, of course, you know, in terms of indigenous populations and the environmental impact up north. But now that it's here and now that it's functioning better than most around the world, I mean, I think Hydro-Québec is one of the largest and most progressive energy companies in the world, actually. We're fortunate to have that. So we can shift our concerns from fuel switching, which, you know, a lot of provinces are still struggling immensely with getting off of fossil fuels. We don't have to worry about that so much, and we can move on to transport and electrification of industry and a bunch of other things, and, you know, buildings, for instance. So I think we're in a really great situation here right now, considering the current state of the planet, actually.
For sure. One of your projects, I know, was it involved China, that What was that one called? It was the...
That was the Solar Decathlon.
Okay. So can you describe that project?
Yeah, that was insane.
You've told me before it was a bit insane, but...
Yeah. It was... So there's an annual competition that started in the United States called the Solar Decathlon Competition, which is basically for university teams to design and build a net zero energy home. And then to display it, and it enters into an energy efficiency competition. Well, there's 10 competitions, actually. 5 measured, 5 juried, and it's been going for 25, 30 years, I think, now. And it's kind of been franchised. So there's Solar Decathlon competitions in North America, of course, with Canada and the U.S. That's where it started. But now in China and in the Middle East and Africa and Europe, all over the world. So we did the one... We're invited to do the one in China in, what is that now, 2015, I guess we're invited, and the competition ended up being 2018. It was supposed to be 2017, but it was delayed. And we worked with Concordia University and colleagues over there, and some of the SAGEPs had a student team of, there were about 55 people over in China. We're the only ones actually in the competition that actually built our own home over there. Everyone else had contractors in China to build their home. So I was so proud of our students and our collaborators that worked with us over there. And we did very well. We won 3 of the 5 juried competitions and got 3rd in the other 2 and did very well in the performance ones. And again, Hydro-Québec was a major partner in that, as well as a bunch of other supply chain actors here in Quebec. We tried to keep the people, the companies that we're using and engaging with were mostly Quebec-based. And yeah, it was quite an experience. And I think it's still... It actually led for the university to realize, you know, that we can do these kind of large-scale, messy projects, which McGill's not normally known for that. And that's how it was a large part... led to the support for this new research facility we're building out in Saint-Anne de Bellevue. So it actually had a major impact, even though it was, we rebuilt the building, and we built it first at Concordia's campus, took it down, shipped it over. This all seems very absurd in terms of climate change at this point.
Right.
And I agree. But then we rebuilt it over in China in 22 days. So in
my God,
50 degree heat, which was horrible.
God. That's crazy.
Yeah, it was crazy, but we all survived. No injuries. No, a couple light heat strokes, but that was it.
And before we get to the topic of what you're building or planning to build soon in Saint-Anne de Bellevue, I know that you have some criticisms of the traditional green building industry. And so why is that? What is it about it that is maybe not truly green?
That's a great question. Well, it comes down to, as I described as our research program, really looking at a system boundary that's very broad, so that you are very at least aware of some of the environmental impacts that you typical industries like architecture externalize, that they don't account for, because you still make a decision to specify, a certain product, for instance, knowing full well that, you know, concrete is a nasty material, but also that there's a basically a global mafia on sand trade now, which is causing erosion effects on the coasts, which has another environmental impact. So, you know, these decisions have multiple consequences to them, and you need to really look at it in a holistic way, a deep, deep, deep way. And
From cradle to grave, sort of. Right?
Yeah, cradle to grave, when I said calculating how much energy it took for the sun to grow a tree, that's even beyond the cradle. That's, that's from the very, very beginning. And these have many different temporal and spatial scales. So that's why it's very complicated and complex for a lot of industries to account for it, even if they wanted to. But in the context of global late capitalism, a lot of companies don't want to do that. They know full well, but they don't want to do that. So, and a lot of the green green architecture sort of certifications and
like LEED, for example.
Like LEED, for example. Do not do that, and do that consciously so at times. So there's also a heavy political dimension to this, and of course economic. So we're really trying to be critical of, and but also to offer up solutions to accounting for our impact in a much more holistic way on this earth, from our perspective, an architectural and urban and, you know, community perspective. But it, I think it affects a whole several other disciplines, several other industries, and hopefully policy. You know, I mean, the government also is guilty of looking at things in a very narrow way. And sometimes, you know, the old adage, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Well, that's kind of where we're at. You know, I mean, a lot of people have good intentions right now, but if they're doing it in a too simplistic of a way, sometimes the impacts are totally not what they intend, and actually worse than what they're trying to solve. So,
And I know you're a fan of using wood in building. And is there a reason why, how you could explain that, or what's the...
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at a lot of biogenic materials. So not just wood, but also, say, straw from winter wheat and other materials like that that are typically byproducts. I mean, the wood and forestry supply chain has a lot of applications in for building. It also, of course, has a lot of impacts for just carbon sequestration and healthy environments in general. I mean, wood is a great product in buildings from a psychological standpoint, from a health and well-being standpoint. So we're looking at a lot of those. And we have a robust industry, obviously, here in Canada. And we're really... it's mostly in a typical Canadian way based on extraction, but there's more and more value-added sort of processing that's happening now because the architecture industry is driving more wood construction right now, and people are wanting it. So once we get through a lot of the regulations and fire code-related issues that are... they're well-known. We know there's not a problem, but it takes a while for policy and the code and other things to catch up to that. So we're trying to push it as far as we can within that context. And wood construction is also one of those things that, you know, the Quebec trades know very well, you know, so that's another positive benefit for it. So, and I got some colleagues looking at it in fairly radical ways, like using wood not just as structure, but also as thermal regulating enclosures and things like that. So we're hoping to... my colleague Sal Craig, for instance, is trying to use all wood construction to obviate mechanical systems, so we don't have to use so much energy, and we don't have to also buy and purchase and install this equipment that breaks down after 30 years. And then, of course, there's the issue of just longer-term resilience of our buildings, because we know that there's a lot of buildings today that are fine, but in 30 years, when the climate has changed as it's projected to change, they're not going to be livable anymore. So these are using these kind of materials will allow us to adapt to that more readily.
And is there any truth to the idea that the way we used to build homes was more durable than today?
That's a tough question, because as the climate changes, and as you know, the way we used to build homes, the way we build homes today are they're a factor of what architects intend, but they're also a factor of the supply chain and the economy and what people want and et cetera. So, I don't know if it's there's definitely lessons on that point. There's lessons we know of from past. Past building practices, for instance, that were much better at storing thermal mass, for instance. And those are concepts we've known for literally thousands of years. But during the modernist period of the 20th century, because we thought air conditioning was the be-all, end-all of things, we forgot those principles and started installing again all this complicated mechanical systems and high embodied energy equipment and glass and things, you know, that have, we now know what the consequences are for the environment more globally. So reviving some of those old ideas, you know, and I think my back coming from North Dakota and just having a farming background allows me to see that. Like sometimes I think when I'm teaching to my students, my grandfather's rolling his grave saying, well, of course, you know, that's obvious, right? But it's not so obvious anymore when we've forgotten these things. So no doubt we're referring back to those kind of traditions that make sense today and trying to give them a new life and a new expression in their current situation.
Okay. And one of the things that also I think influenced your barn, well, maybe first describe the barn project, because you know where the funding came from and how it came together.
The barn was an application we made to the Canadian Foundation for Innovation, and that's the major institution. It's actually an endowment that the federal government set up when we actually had surpluses back in the around 2000. Paul Martin did it and put billions into it. And it was meant to be an endowment to revitalize the infrastructure of universities and hospitals, basically. So it's only for hard stuff, you know, like buildings and equipment. It doesn't fund projects and people. So we applied for that, and it was a big round. It was the big innovation round. We got great support from the university, from Martha Crago in particular, from VP Research, for this project. And it was, and because she was very well aware of, as well as Yves Beauchamp, who's a VP of Administration and Finance, knew about the Solar Decathlon competition because they had supported it, financially speaking, and morally too. So we applied for it and actually got it. And it's basically a facility. It's a full-scale design-build facility, so we can build buildings in it and around it. And it's also got research labs to do some of more of the fundamental research that we're talking about. So we're hoping that it's going to help us create a design-build program from a pedagogical perspective, so students get hands-on experience actually realizing designs and construction techniques, and to do the type of research that would speak to the things I've already talked about in terms of decarbonizing the architecture, engineering, and construction industry. And it's sited adjacent to the Morgan Arboretum, which is one of another research stream we have looking at the, you know, forestry dynamics again and sort of the health of the Arboretum itself. There's several plantations in the Arboretum that need to be culled. So one of the ideas is for us to take out some of that wood, process it, and use it to build buildings in communities around Quebec. The design build program itself is modeled after other ones around the world that do projects that contribute to communities one way or another. So that's something we're building up right now because we want to be ready to really launch some of those projects when Barn is built, hopefully in 2024. We're still working through the design phase right now and some of the permitting and such.
And so when I think of it, I think of it as like, part of it is almost like a big hangar that you could build a house in, and then you could put that house on the back of a truck and wheel it out.
Yeah.
Is that? It's
definitely. And one of the, myself and another colleague are really, one of our major research areas is prefabrication. So we're also looking at prefabrication techniques and technologies that are not just about us being able to build buildings in barn and then ship them somewhere in Quebec and rebuild them, but also to we've got a huge skilled labor shortage, so prefabrication in our industry is something that we're the only major industry in the world that has retarded its development of prefabrication. Like post-war, it was obviously it was an up-and-coming thing in architecture to prefabricate housing and things like that for returning soldiers, etc. And we're the only industry that actually declined from that period. And so our belief is we really need to ramp that up again too. And Quebec actually has a fairly robust prefabrication industry. It's just it's kind of accumulated. It's focus, I guess, is more on chalets and single family residences and things like that. And I think we really need to evolve that industry to address larger scale building projects and retrofit and other aspects of the industry, because we just don't have enough workers and we're not going to have enough workers. And a factory setting is actually a lot more efficient, safer. It reduces a lot of waste than on-site construction. When you really think about on-site construction, it's kind of silly, you know, to be on-site for years sometimes with material sitting outside getting damaged and having to be replaced, and just working in February in Quebec, hammering a nail was not fun. So,
or starting a project in November that was supposed to start in June.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
And then the other thing I sort of envision, I don't know if I'm seeing this right, that if you had something like a house that you built in this hangar, because it's in a closed setting and you're right there with your labs nearby, you could test it in various ways and make some real hard research data from it.
That's exactly it. We have enough land and space around the building as it's designed right now to be able to have test buildings and test pods and test assemblies sitting outside and being monitored. And, you know, we've got sensor networks and weather stations and things like that that we can actually test over a year at least, a full cycle, but even over multiple years. And we intend to do that with a lot of the buildings that we're currently working on right now, at least designing to do a similar sort of methodology. Yes, because the data is critical, because when we want to make certain claims that are going to shape the industry, but the industry needs to have some of those things, the risk management, basically. We need to prove that things work in order for them to adopt them, because a big part of our research team is we want to get these innovations into the industry as quickly as possible, because we collectively agree we don't have a lot of time left. You know, in my opinion, we've already crossed the tipping point. So now we have to start preparing and adapting for a new reality, and this stuff has to happen quick, as soon as possible.
And when you say weather and data, where you're siting the building, I think, is right next to this weather station. Mm-hmm. Do you mean that you could even use some of their data?
Yeah. The historical data out at the Morgan Arboretum and from the Marshall Radar Facility is what it is. It used to be a federal radar facility. McGill still owns it and uses it right now, but the federal government is divested from it because it's a huge, you know, tower with a ball on top.
Right.
Now you can get the same sort of weather data from something that fits in your trunk of your car. So,
right.
Okay. Makes sense.
Okay. Cool. And I know that you've done community engagement design builds in the Gaspé.
Mm-hmm.
And so has that influenced what you're envisioning for St. Anne de Bellevue?
Absolutely, yeah. We like I said, we have a strong commitment to shaping and contributing to the communities around Quebec, not just, you know, downtown Montreal, but St. Anne de Bellevue as a community. We've been working up in Saint-Octave-de-Métis and the Métis MRC, primarily because we have a relationship with the Jardin de Métis, the Reeford Gardens. They have a shop up there. We can set up and actually construct projects up there. So they've always been sort of we think of them as our kind of outpost, you know, our McGill outpost. And it brings in the rural condition really powerfully, but also even more so, it's a coastal, you know, it's right where the ocean starts, and we see the effects of climate change in a much more radical way than we would downtown Montreal. So it's an important community to continue to work with, and McGill's had other relations, is starting to have other relations up there too. So I'm hoping that just gets bigger and bigger and more robust.
And in terms of the students, are students coming in or are they even selecting to go to the School of Architecture because there's the potential to do these kinds of projects that are so hands-on and have so much learning involved in them?
We expect that. We really haven't mounted the program yet because we're actually going through the process with the provincial government to get a new Master's of Science program approved that would then be the main sort of you know, clearinghouse for this. But from already from our experience, because I have been doing design build projects of a smaller nature, a little more ad hoc over the last few years since the Solar Decathlon. And there's a, definitely a very distinct set of students that are super interested in that and really appreciate, maybe it's a factor of social media or whatever, but getting, you know, hands-on experience, working with materials, seeing the results in a physical, tangible way, and having it be meaningful. I mean, the projects we do are meant to shape a community or help a community or address climate change in some way, and that's just something that I think this generation is super concerned about. So it's not for everybody. I'm not going to say that, but there's definitely, I think as a pedagogy, as a way of teaching, it's profound. You can, it sticks, you know, it's not like a lecture in a classroom and you see the results, you literally are embodying the issues because you're physically making them.
And in cases where you were doing that with students in the Gaspé, can you recount one particular project or story that was really great for students?
Well, I mean, one of the projects we did up there, for instance, was, I mean, the Solar Decathlon competition, by the way, shaped multiple careers. We have students that participate in that are now working for energy and environment companies and architecture firms. And engineering firms. That was a massive influence on a number of people, like life-changing, really. In the Gaspé, for instance, we did a simple stage for the
Jardin des Métis.
The Jardin des Métis, and
so that you could have concerts and
so
like.
They can have concerts. It's from the original design of the current facility up there. They built a big berm, and they always intended to have a some sort of venue at the end of the international festival area in the gardens, but they never had the stage. So we did the stage and. Both McGill and the students that were involved in that have seen how much of an impact that's had for the community up there. It's Alexander Reford, the director of the gardens up there, has programmed it constantly through the summers now. It brings in the community. It's a huge. I mean, the gardens are, I think, one of Quebec's largest tourist attractions. They get hundreds of thousands of visitors, you know. And during the pandemic, Quebecers discovered it. And so now it's even more on some level. It's such an amazing place. And they've done such a good job at with the gardens and curating in events and all kinds of things. The festival is amazing. So that's a very prominent project for us up there, and it gets a lot of attention. So we get a lot more requests to do things as well. But we really are looking to ramp it up from more of a pavilion or stage level thing to buildings and to, you know, larger projects that might take multiple years, but will have a greater impact and actually be... The other part of it is just be more valuable to us as researchers, you know, to be able to get data and to see the impacts of things.
And from an institution point of view, like Jardin des Métis, or from a municipality point of view, what is the benefit of having students or people from the School of Architecture working on a project where they not only help design it, but also build it?
Well, for smaller communities, it probably represents a project they wouldn't get done otherwise, because it's maybe the money's not there, the support's not there, the ideas aren't there, whatever. I mean, we contribute a lot of our own free labor to it and free expertise to it, and we get a lot out of it from being able to have that opportunity to actually test these things out and to put them out there in the world. So it's a very symbiotic relationship, I think, and these communities, you know, when the program is really up and running, there's going to be a whole vetting process and a whole conversation. Well, what is it that, what you need? Sometimes it's about doing, you know, a building that has, it's, I call it a leverage point. You know, it's something you install in a community and it has a much bigger impact, a ripple effect from it, you know. And those are the ones we're looking for, because we obviously can't keep building full communities or anything like that. But we can insert buildings or projects that make people talk, that make people say, hey, we can do that. You know, we can, you know, it's not, we're trying to mitigate any trepidation, any risk that communities have may feel either perceived or actual that prevent them from addressing the climate change problematic, basically.
Hmm. And what's my other question related to that? In terms of what's going on in the rest of the world, in the U.S. or in Europe, is what you're trying to do here unique, or is there some other examples that you know of in the world that you admire? Or
yeah, for sure. We I mean, the barn, the N is a node. So we're considering it as one facility within a network. So we have a network of researchers primarily in the U.S. and Europe right now. That have similar sort of programs, I would say. I don't think once barn is built, we're going to have a facility that most don't have, but some do. So, for instance, we just had colleagues over from Finland and Denmark as part of a grant that the Danes got called the Arctic Wood Architecture Network. So it was more of an exploratory grant where we're getting together to see each other's facilities and contexts. So when they were here, we went all the way up to the Gaspé, actually, and toured a series of mills and wood production, mass timber facilities, research facilities at Laval and Quebec City, as well as Cerex and some other companies up in the Gaspé that do really interesting work in timber architecture, mass timber architecture, basically. So, you know, their facilities over in Denmark and Finland, they both have kind of design build programs as well as a pedagogical tactic, I would say. So those, our partners have those kind of shared methods and concerns. And the network's fairly large, but it's still developing. And so I think we'll figure out what tangible work we can do together over the years, especially once barn is built.
Okay. Well, let's take a little break for some music and messages here on Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We're talking to Michael Gemtrude, who is an associate professor in the School of Architecture here at McGill University, and he is the chair in Architecture, Energy, and Environment. And he's actually part of the Faculty of Engineering, because the School of Architecture is of the Faculty of Engineering. So we're going to continue talking about these important topics. So stay tuned with us, and we'll take a little break for some music and some messages here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
I don't mind you coming here, wasting all my time, 'cause when you're standing oh so near, I kinda lose my mind. It's not the perfume that you wear, it's not the ribbons in your hair. I don't mind you coming here and wasting all my time. We'll be right back.
David Suzuki, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Information to grow the brain.
The Montreal International Documentary Festival is celebrating its 25th edition, a unique opportunity to enjoy the best documentary films from all around the world.
This fall, the RIDM returns exclusively to theaters and venues with screenings, festivities, and much more.
See you from November 17th to the 27th.
Discover the full program at RIDM.ca.
The RIDM, where all stories meet.
Join us on Thursday, December 15th at La Sotarena for a community concert featuring performances by Johnny Void and Ida Toninato, a duo of Joseph Sanacandro and Stefan Christoff presenting La Lumière du Soleil dans un semi-sous-sol, a trio, Esther Boldage, Nicolas de Cross, and Alessandro Garino. Taking place December 15th, La Sotrena, 4848 Saint Laurent. Doors 8 p.m., music 9. Pre-sale $12, $15 at the door. This show is co-presented by Everyday Ego, Howell Arts, and CKUT. See you there.
And you're listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. We took a little break for some music and messages. The tune we heard was Just What I Needed, which you might be familiar with as a song from The Cars originally, but that was from Scott Bradley's Postmodern Jukebox. And I think it was from the album New Gramophone Who Dis. But that's a neat little band that sort of takes popular songs, pop songs, and changes them around in terms of the style that they do them in, and they'll do them in like a 1920s ragtime style, or they'll jazz it up. So really cool group of artists to check out, and they have, you know, guest vocalists and so on. So as I said, you're listening to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today in the studio, we've been talking to Michael Gemtrude, who is an associate professor at the School of Architecture in the Faculty of Engineering here at McGill University, and he is the chair in Architecture, Energy, and Environment. And we've been talking about some of the exciting projects that he's involved in. And one of them is Reconstruct, which is Building Climate Retrofit Solutions for Canada, which was an INSERC grant, mm-hmm. which had, I guess, as a partner, Hydro-Québec and the Quebec Ministry of Energy and Natural Resources. So can you tell me a little bit about Reconstruct, Michael?
Sure. It's a really exciting project. I'm really happy with this one. It's a fairly large grant. It's for 5 years. It's the overall intention is to build out a deep energy retrofit program, basically for Quebec, but also Canada. We're starting with Quebec because it's where we live. It's also proven that these kind of programs are very regionally based because they're so highly dependent upon supply chain, what the energy source is, and of course in Quebec it's a very specific energy source. I guess Manitoba and BC would have similar sort of, you know, issues, but the rest of Canada has different ones. And as you mentioned, Hydro-Québec is a major sponsor of it, as well as the Ministry of Energy and Natural Resources here in Quebec, and then NSERC matches all that money. So it's a large grant. It's got a fairly large team on it right now. It's going to grow. We really are just getting going, frankly. We received the money in February, but we ramped up for kind of a summer beginning to it for starting the research, and now we're at the point where things are finally settling down and we're really starting to focus on it. One of the interesting aspects of it is a series of pilot projects that are real. That this is a very applied grant. It's not a real esoteric research grant. We have some fundamental research happening, of course, but it's really looking at implementing a program that can be actually, you know, engaged by a number of stakeholders. So we're doing these pilot projects, and they're real projects. We're looking at some buildings to do a deep energy retrofit of, and the way we're approaching it is from an envelope perspective. So the first one of our students refers to it as putting a sweater over a building. So it's basically applying a new envelope to make it perform at a higher level in terms of energy efficiency, replacing the mechanical systems to address that. And in the end, and by the way, these are all buildings that are already going to be retrofitted. So we're trying to find the policy and the financial frameworks around that will make them more feasible, because they're, you know, they are a little more expensive. And we know from other programs around the world that there's always some public monies that have to go into these projects and these programs to bridge that gap. But our role more in it is to try to get the industry to adopt it. So we are trying to do design and research related kind of investigations to mitigate the risk for the industry and for communities to adopt these programs more quickly. And I mean, there's been a number of reports out, but for Canada to meet its climate change objectives around the retrofitting of cities and buildings, we should be doing thousands of buildings a year, and we're doing maybe hundreds, you know, at most across Canada. So we're part of a larger national network too, that's looking at, and the federal government is investing a lot of money into these retrofit programs and accelerator programs to try to encourage it and to make it more of a standard industry process. So we're just, and these are early days in that. I mean, the federal government hasn't really even announced this yet. We know they've allocated the money for it in the budget. So we're talking to groups from Nova Scotia to BC about this, and to be participating in that, as well as a lot of local, you know, actors, and Hydro-Québec being one of the main ones that's pushing retrofit. The new president at Hydro-Québec is very keen on these kind of initiatives rather than building more capacity for energy. I mean, I know that to take the money it would take to build a new dam and put it into actual the physical environment makes a lot of sense.
You know, in Ontario, and I know in other jurisdictions, if you have some sort of renewable energy feature on your home, like solar panels or wind or something like that, that you can feed back into the grid, and that you're almost paid, I think, by Ontario Hydro, right? Mm-hmm. But here in Quebec, we don't have a scenario like that still.
Yeah, we're working on that.
Do you think that's on the horizon?
Yeah, I think that there's going to be a number of different, incentives and sort of economic realities that are going to drive that more and more. I know one of the things that the city of Montreal and the province and Hydro-Québec are looking at is more neighborhood sort of distributed energy networks, so people can share energy and actually have more energy security for a greater population than just, you know, one individual homeowner, which makes a lot of sense to me, because the grid, the energy grid we have, is probably our greatest civic asset. And it is a civic asset explicitly in Quebec, because we own Hydro-Québec technically. So in other places like Ontario, when you have several privatized companies, it's more complicated. And I think those kind of direct kind of incentive, you know, meter, basically the meter running one way when you're producing and running the other way when you're consuming, and at the end of the year you get either some money back or you have a much lower energy bill. Those are more common when you have a privatized system like in Ontario or Pennsylvania or Massachusetts or what have you. So I think we're going to get there, but it's going to be in a very Quebec way. It's going to be more of a social, you know, kind of decision, which I agree with, because the grid is ours.
Right. I know that, for example, I know a woman that lives, a woman and man that live on a property near Ormstown, and they have kind of retrofitted their own home, and they have a very steep roof, mm-hmm. and they just covered it in solar panels, mm-hmm. and she told me that, you know, she had been told, oh, there's no way that you'll end up with a net zero home, but she has. Like, mm-hmm. she tells me, you know, she pays nothing for energy and,
yep.
you know, so.
Yeah, no, but that's why in our program, why we're starting with the envelope, the first key to this is that we call it a fabric first approach. So the envelope needs to perform in a way that you're not needing to consume so much energy. And I've got my passive house certifications, and that's a specific building technique that is super insulates buildings, basically. And I know of passive house buildings in Quebec, Vermont, that never really need to turn on its heat source. There's enough heat being generated in the house from the appliances, the computers, the bodies. Of course, these are not McMansions. These are reasonable homes. And that's enough to heat it. And, you know, if the power goes out, they're good for a week. They don't have to worry about pipes freezing and stuff like that just because the envelope is performing so well. So, you know, it's a whole system we're talking about here, you know, and off-the-grid homes. I mean, I have my own kind of skepticism around photovoltaic panels, for instance, because especially in Quebec, when we have a hydro source that's fairly, well, very cheap, too cheap in my mind for our energy, but that's a political football. Solar panels they're great in certain circumstances, and I'm an advocate in but the context needs to be considered. The amount of embodied carbon, embodied energy, and the nasty materials that go into PV panels is really immense. Again, looking at this expanded system boundary. So when you know that the cobalt in our phones and in PV panels is being mined by hand in Africa, and people are dying in their late 20s because of that, you got to consider those things when you're specifying an energy system like that. It shouldn't just be virtue signaling. It has to have a real reason for it. And in Quebec, that reason is less than it is in other parts of the world. That's all I'd say.
And China, you hear at least that they made a push to be more complete in their energy makeup and be more renewable, even though we know that they still build lots of coal plants and in terms of massive hydroelectric dams, they have pretty gigantic one. Is it true that they've changed the game a little bit when it comes to photovoltaics or
I mean, China's changed the game on a lot of things geopolitically right now. They're driving a lot of things, resource extraction being one of the main ones.
The demand is there. So because they've got the money to buy these things are being mined.
Yeah. And they've installed themselves in countries where these, you know, resources are, just like the United States and Canada has over the years. When we're in China for the solar decathlon competition, for instance, one of the things that was happening was a lot of the PV factories were shutting down because they had flooded the market with cheap PV panels, and the U.S. was catching up and others, and it crashed the market at one point, and had a lot of implications for the resource supply chain for all of those. So I think particularly post-pandemic now, countries are starting to have to be more self-sufficient on these because we realized how fragile that supply chain is. And with the way the geopolitics are working right now, I think there's even more of an impetus to do that. So I think you're going to see manufacture happening outside of China, and that's going to also drive a different, you know, I guess, pricing and financial structure and supply chain in general. So there's a lot of advances in those technologies right now. I just saw a PV panel that was hitting 31% efficiency, which, you know, 19 is kind of the norm. So we'll see where it goes. And I think some of, you know, replacing some of these heavy metals and precious metals that are in them is also a huge area of research, which would have a major impact. So,
but then that's why there is this focus to some degree on the building envelope, because that's then not tied to these rare metals that are being mined for
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, a lot of the envelope systems right now still have some pretty high embodied carbon insulations and things. That's why we're focused on looking more at biogenic materials for insulation. And
how do you define biogenic? It's
biogenic being anything that, you know, mostly we're looking at waste products from the forestry industry, the farming industry, things that sequester carbon. That's, you know, versus, you know, this kind of fossil fuel based supply chain, right. You know, which is still what goes into a lot of building products. Right. So
because straw in a straw bale sequesters carbon.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's a waste material normally. So,
right.
I think those circular economies, that I have one colleague, Naomi Kina, that's her bailiwick. That's what she does. And those, again, operate at small scales, large scales, and then immense scales. So having those kind of discussions related to every decision we're making is really important. Design for disassembly, you know, part of the reason why we can't recycle a lot of materials or reuse a lot of materials is because they're all in these sandwich situations that you can't actually separate them out, so they end up in the landfill. So that's another aspect that we're looking very closely at. And the biogenic materials in that area are really impactful.
And there is obviously a major issue with construction waste, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of waste that just does go into end up in the landfill. And
yes.
And so there is a philosophy, I think, on your part as well, that if you're going to do a new build and there's an existing building on the site, to recycle as much of that into the new build? Is that?
Yeah, that's one of them. I mean, the first principle is that, I mean, the most sustainable thing to do is not build new. I mean, I know that sounds funny coming from an architect, but if you can actually keep a building and give it another 50 years to its life, you have diverted a lot of carbon from the landfill, you've kept it in place, so you're not contributing anymore, and you normally don't have to have nearly as much material to make it functional for another 50 years. So, and you know, we build pretty well here in North America. So these buildings, if they're not driven by certain development decisions, like, well, tear it down because I can build a tower or whatever, then they've got a higher value. I mean, it's an incredible sunk investment of trillions of dollars and, you know, trillions of tons of carbon in our existing infrastructure. And, you know, 80 to 90% of the buildings that we're going to be living in 2040 are already here. So that should be much more of a focus in our industry than it currently is, frankly. We don't, we typically let the development industry drive, you know, these kind of decisions. But I think architects need to be more advocates and enter into the policy and political realm a lot more fully. So, and that's one thing we talk to our students about often. So,
well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. We're basically out of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been very interesting to hear about all of this. And we've been talking to Michael Gemtrude, who is an associate professor at the School of Architecture in the Faculty of Engineering here at McGill University. And he is the chair in Architecture, Energy, and Environment. And you can check him out on the McGill.ca website on his page. And all his information is there, including a list of these various projects that we've been talking about today on the show. So thanks for listening to Equilibrium. You can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/EquilibriumCKUTMontreal. We have a little affiliated type podcast on Spotify called the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. It's in the process of being moved over to, I guess, the CKUT website and the series of podcasts that are here on the station. But you can still find it on Spotify as the Equilibrium Radio Podcast. And you can go to our website, equilibriumradio.weebly.com. And if you have any comments or suggestions to send us for the show, you can always email us at equilibriumckut.ca. I'm Ryan Young, and thanks for listening to today's show. So have a great rest of your day.
Previously broadcast program. Saturday, the 26th of November at IRSA. Award-winning Nova Scotian funeral director-turned-songwriter Tara Spencer and explosive special guest Ben Kaplan are pairing up for one night only in Montreal to celebrate the release of their brand-new joint album, Old News. Written by Tara and produced by Ben, this collection of songs is a tender and cheeky portrait of the art of saying goodbye, captured with live off-the-floor energy. Please join us at Montreal's beloved music venue, IRSA, located at 5589 Park Avenue at the corner of St. Viateur, on Saturday the 26th of November for this very special and intimate show. Doors are at 6:30 with delicious food and drinks available. Show is at 8 and tickets are $17. For tickets, links, and more information on this show and others, please visit us at ursamtl.com and on Facebook and Instagram at ursamtl. A CKUT program.
Wait a minute, that's too fast.
Now what?
Kick it over here, baby pop!
CKUT, yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your positive vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Mancha, I hit and switches, keep it right. Decipher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do with my...